Welcome to the Brown Thomas Podcast. In today's podcast, I speak to one of Ireland's brightest literary stars, Caroline O'Donoghue, author of two best-selling novels, journalist, and host of her very own award-winning podcast, Sentimental Garbage. We talk about her brand new novel, Scenes of a Graphic Nature, the warm community of her fellow novelists, and her very first job in Brown Thomas. I'm Louise Duffy, and this is the Brown Thomas Podcast. Welcome, Caroline. Welcome to the podcast. It's so lovely to have you on with us today. How are you?
I'm delighted to be here, Louise. Thank you so much for having me on. I feel very flattered to be asked.
Oh, well, look, it's so lovely to chat to you. And we're going to talk about the incredible career that you've carved, but we have to go right back. We're going to start at the start. And you are of the alumni of Brown Thomas.
Do you know what, Louise? This is an exclusive scoop for you. This is the one area of my life. I'm amazed that there are any areas left in my life that I haven't mined mercilessly for content. But I've actually never written about this or anything. So, yeah. My first ever proper salaried payroll job was at Brown Thomas in Cork in the lingerie department.
In the lingerie department.
Yeah.
What was that like? So how old were you when you started there?
I was 17. Yeah. It was the summer I was going into my leaving cert.
Okay.
I would have been about 17.
And what was it like?
Well, honestly, this is so embarrassing because it's a real tell of where my head was at when I was 17. Mm-hmm. Because I was in my head, I was punk rock, even though there was literally no physical sort of showers of that. I wasn't cool enough to have piercings or tattoos or an adventurous sense of style. I just knew how to play Everybody Hurts on guitar. So that made me alternative kind of thing.
Wow, you're so edgy.
So edgy. Yeah, it's so embarrassing thinking back. But then, I think it's the same wherever there's a Brown Thomas, really, to be a Brown Thomas girl is it's got this cachet around it. And I went to this sort of this all girls semi-private school called Sculvera in Cork, which was everyone there was always crowding up the cosmetic tables. And so to be working in Brown Thomas, particularly on the ground floor, where everyone was trying on the Juicy Tubes Lancome lip glosses, which were so huge at the time. It was a status thing at the time.
That's amazing. Yeah. So it all links back, right? And let's talk about the second book, okay? So you've just released this to the world, Scenes of a Graphic Nature. Congratulations, first and foremost. What is it like? What is it like to release your work to the world like this? It has to be such a flurry of emotions when it's gone from you.
It was very, very interesting, this one, because the debut, my Promising Young Women was my debut, came out in 2018. And I think there's so much goodwill for debut authors.
Of course.
And there's also a lot of attention for debut authors. Mm-hmm. And there's lots of every magazine, every newspaper will be like, oh, here are the hot new things. Here are the new young voices.
Yeah,
coming through. There's less of that for people who are putting out their second novels. There's less of an infrastructure. And also there's a whole new bevy of new talent that's coming up the ranks as well. So it's hard not to feel. And second novels are notoriously difficult to write because, it took me sort of 27 years to write my first novel. And it took me 2 years to write my second. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And so you've kind of... Yeah, it's a very vulnerable thing anyway. And then you feel as if that there isn't as much marketing infrastructure to catch.
Yeah.
That can be quite, make you quite insecure. And then at the beginning of this year, at the beginning of 2020, I was freaking out because I was just, I don't know, I was just so afraid that I wasn't a good book and all the general things. And it was driving me batty. But then, what the weird thing that happened was that when lockdown hit, I got a phone call from my publishers in around May, and they were like, look, all the bookshops are closed. You're due to come out on June 8th. We can't release it into this climate because there'll be no one to buy it.
Okay.
And obviously, that made complete sense, from an economical standpoint. But it really, I was just like, oh, God, it really kind of threw me off. And I was like, oh, no, my entire sort of mental calendar for this book, the sort of like, oh, I'm going to release it in this time, I'm going to be talking about it in this time, I'm going to be interviewing about it in this time, all that was thrown off. But yeah. Then I started a day feeling very upset about it. And then...
whatever will be. And that was our, like, our mentality shifted completely, didn't it?
Completely, yeah. And the sort of to be worried about yourself as the crisis got worse and worse became so much more like, what are you doing? And like, I was like, look, it probably won't do very well. And there's nothing anyone can do about it. And it was very freeing to just like stop letting it be my responsibility that this book do well. I was like, look...
yeah.
Literally, there's nowhere to buy it. You know?
Exactly. So, like, I mean, for it to sell anything at all was, you know,
yeah.
a bonus. But how well it has done, Caroline. I mean, so for research purposes, I Google imaged, if that's how we say it, scenes of a graphic nature, right? And it's all just your book cover. So you've managed to push out all the scenes of a graphic nature which previously existed on Google. Can you, that's quite a piece. That's quite a piece.
I've literally never thought of it that way. And that's actually amazing.
Yeah, maybe I didn't check videos, which include scenes of a graphic nature, but Google Images, it's all you. I mean, it's done so well.
It's so funny because I do hear this.
Yeah.
I anecdotally hear that it is doing well. But because the world has gotten so small, there's very few ways for me to see it doing well. Like usually you would go to like a bookstore event and there'd be loads of people queuing up to sign it. And that would be a kind of a gauge. But because there's no gauge, it sort of feels like it's doing well in a parallel universe a bit.
Mm-hmm. And do you feel a little, okay, so look, I mean, we all have reasons to feel, I suppose, cheated out of things that were meant to happen this year. But that's a very big part of the process, you know, meeting the people who love your work so much. And, you know, the whole book tour, like to go on that and to interact. So that was all taken away.
It was a bit, yeah, and you're right, I did feel a bit cheated because I feel, this might be a bit too, I'm sort of conscious that I'm not romantic enough about novel writing and that maybe I talk too much about the marketing and the business side of things, but that's just kind of how my mind often works. But it is my business, but what it comes down to for me is that there are the vast majority of authors that you meet hate publicity and they hate going to bookshops and they hate the awkwardness of there only being 12 people at the bookshop event and they hate the awkward chat and the signing queue. They hate not knowing what to say because a lot of authors are extremely introverted people and that's why they chose the job.
Mm-hmm.
And what I discovered about myself when Promising Young Women came out is that I love all of this job. I love the writing, but I love meeting people and I love doing the events. I don't care if only 12 people come, if they're the right 12 people. And what I found in my sort of journey with that was if you really like the publicity part, it can make your job so much easier because it's kind of a niche you can carve out for yourself where you can literally say to your like publicist, look, I know novels are very hard to sell. I know there are 600 novels coming out, you know, this week alone or whatever, but I will cut every ribbon. I will kiss every baby. I will push on this. I will do anything you need me to do. Yeah. And that is and that's been really helpful in my career so far that I'm able to do that, where a lot of people don't feel like they are.
And, you know, you mentioned other authors being somewhat introverted. You're the very opposite, you know, and I think that I often think about the life of an author and I can only imagine it's what a lot of us kind of, you know, were shocked into when we all had to work from home. So like, was lockdown any different from your normal life bar, you know, bars and restaurants being closed? Like your existence was probably similar in that, you know, you set your own routine, you work from home, your uniform might be a pair of leggings. Like what was that for you?
Yeah, no, it was interesting. I did find myself in a place of like giving advice to friends of like how to make this job work because you're right, my job didn't change at all. My routine didn't change at all. The only thing that actually changed was that we live in a very small flat in London. It's like a 1.5 bedroom and the half bedroom is kind of like a little study, but you would be hard pressed to, like it's so small that the bed that we have in there folds into the wall like a 1920s sort of Murphy bed.
Falls out of the wall and the magic begins.
Exactly. So that's where I was typically doing my work. And it was a fine sized flat when my boyfriend was at work all day. But when he started working from home constantly, and he's a graphic designer, and so he talked to a lot of clients on Zoom, I found it impossible. It was like really difficult.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But now, weirdly, I find it hard, because like then a few weeks ago, he had to go on a business trip for about 4 days, and I was looking forward to it all month. I was like, yeah, I'm going to get like 5,000 words done every day. And then as soon as he left, I was like, oh, I quite miss him now. Do you know what I mean? Yeah.
I think coming out of it was probably harder for a lot of people than going into it, you know, because you do settle into that, you know, you get used to it and the walls close in for a while and you know, you have to adjust. Yeah. Coming out of it, the other side almost feels a little trickier, doesn't it?
I do. I'm very, very interested in the kind of the, obviously this has been a horrible time for a lot of people. They've lost people they've loved. And all of the terrible things. I don't need to cite them again here because we're all sick of hearing about them. But I think there is a small minority of people who are just kind of whispering to themselves, like, I don't want my life back. Do you know what I mean? I think
and reassessing the lives we had, you know? So let's talk. So once you've released the book to the world, and you know, the process that comes then afterwards, let's talk about, as an author, your relationship with critiques and reviews. You know, you've had amazing reviews for this book, blisteringly funny and clever being one of the most intelligent, well-observed depictions of lust, loss, envy, betrayal, of love that I've ever read. People are crazy about this book. But tell me, you personally, what your relationship is with those reviews. I know before you compared it to like a performance review at work, except publicly and thousands of them. What's it like?
You know what? The interesting thing about that is that the reviews themselves, so I convinced myself that this was going to get the worst reviews ever. I was convinced that everybody was going to hate it. Mm-hmm. And I was, thankfully, I was very wrong. And I've had to like apologize to so many of my friends because I've spent the last year being like, and they're going to hate it. And when they hate it, here's what I'm going to do. And they're like, yeah, you've bored us to tears for 2 years basically over this thing that now everybody loves. So I was like, sorry. So I feel so lucky about that. But I have had bad reviews before, and it is interesting because the review itself, and sometimes they can be fair negative reviews where you look at it and you're like, yeah, I get it. Mm-hmm. And sometimes they can be slightly unfair, quite bitchy reviews where it almost feels like you're taking something that you think you know about me and you're applying it to this fictional work. And that feels very unfair. Or you're making a comment on where you think I'm from or something, you know.
Yeah.
And so those are kind of, they hurt, but they're quite easy to dismiss because it's very easy as a writer to say like, oh, well, that person's clearly bringing their own baggage to this thing.
Yeah.
But and honestly, you get over that in about 6 hours, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
What I think is harder to get over is the people in your life who also read the reviews, because it is a performance review,
of course,
made public, and of course they're googling you and they're excited for you or whatever, and then they feel sorry for you because they have a job where they could never imagine this kind of thing being broadcast about them. They feel very protective of you.
Yeah.
And then they're in a rush to text you or to call you being like, here's why this person is full of crap. And you're just a bit like, I would really rather we just moved on and didn't talk about it.
I would rather you tiptoed around that and ignored it completely. But it's funny. Yeah. I can only compare it to working in radio, which I did for about a decade. And text messages would come in when you're on air.
Yeah.
And there could be 100 lovely, pleasant people who'd be like, wow, that was a lovely song. And oh, I agree with you or whatever. But it's the one person that texts you and calls you whatever, an insufferable bore or whatever it might be, or probably the most PC that you'd get. But like, it's the one, as you say, it takes a couple of hours for that to dissipate, you know, and that you're thinking about it that evening when you get home. But you do have to develop that thick skin, I guess, don't you?
You really do. Yeah. And the mantra that I have with it is like, it's actually a Muriel Spark line. And it's, you know, for people who like this kind of thing, this is the kind of thing that they like. And it sounds quite strange and quite simple, but it's like, when someone likes the book a lot, I'm like, oh, it's because they like this kind of thing.
Yeah.
And when they don't like the book, it's like, oh, because they don't like this kind of thing. Exactly. And it's much easier, I think, to see yourself as part of a genre, part of a thing people like or don't like. And it's not about you. It's about, you know, everything is just preference synonyms. Do you know what I mean? Absolutely. It's just like...
Well, let's talk about the genre, because before you said, you know, nationality has been seen as a genre, like, and the Irish genre, you know, the Irish author genre was, it has changed. It has changed now. It's female, it's sharp, it's witty. And what's happening, you know, in the world, the impact Irish female authors are having in the world, like yourself, Sinead Gleeson, Sally Rooney, like, it's exciting. It must be really exciting to be part of that.
It's so exciting, and it's wonderful as well, because I remember when I was a teenager and I wanted to be a writer, and I had a lot of guy friends who also wanted to be writers. And I really felt like they had so much legacy that they were so eager to grab at, like your Joyce's, your Beckett's, you know, Brian Friel, all these like incredible Irish voices that we're so good at celebrating as a country. But I didn't feel like there was any room in that for me. And obviously I know now as an adult woman that there are plenty of Irish female writers who I now take huge amounts of inspiration from. Like I think like Maeve Binchy is one of my favorite writers, and Nuala O'Fuilán is a huge influence on me as well. But I wasn't being handed those things as a teenage girl. I was being handed Joyce and being told to see myself in it. And I didn't. I was like, just people talking shite around Dublin. I don't get it. Do you know what I mean?
And there's the review.
Oh, Donna, who trashes like rival Joyce.
You just don't like that kind of thing. It's okay, Caroline. Don't worry about it.
I just don't like that kind of thing. But I remember the, just feeling like they were modeling themselves on all these heroes. And even now when you walk into any kind of independent bookshop in Ireland and there's all these fridge magnets and tea towels with like all these Irish literary heroes on them, and they're all men, even though we have such a plentiful supply of like great Irish writers, female writers. But anyway, now in the next few years, the term Irish writer has come to mean something. Obviously, those great men still exist, and for good reason. But like, it's become something totally different. It has become this sort of, it's a byword for women who are able to write in this kind of biting, witty, truthful, poetic, honest way about their lives, but who also aren't taking themselves too seriously. Do you know what I mean? Totally. And I was actually listening to the Hilo a while ago when they reviewed Scenes of Graphic Nature, and they were reviewing like loads of different books, and they realized to themselves, Pandora and Dolly, as they were talking, they were like, God, a lot of the books that we're raving about lately are Irish. And then either Pandora or Dolly said something like, yeah, I think it's because Irish women are really good at writing about terrible things, but they don't bum you out at the same time. I was like, we are.
Yeah, but that's perfect. You know, and from the outside, it's nice you mentioned that, because Dolly, you know, her review is on the front of your book, and Marion Keyes, and it appears to be a very friendly industry. You know, even Kathy Kelly appearing on your podcast. What's it like? What is the relationship like with your fellow authors?
I mean, I think I would die without it, honestly. Yeah. I think because this job is so specific. It's there's not really a lot of jobs like it. And people make a lot of assumptions about it. People make assumptions about, for example, if you're in the paper a few times a month or whatever in 1 month, people assume who aren't in the business that you now think that you're great, and they feel like they can just leverage a lot of criticism at you just because they feel like you need to be taken down a peg. That's a very real thing that happens. I'm sure you've had it happen to you as well. And people sort of make assumptions about the money that you make, which is either way less or way more than you actually do make, and they are condescending about that, and they make weird unless you have like a sort of society of women around you who are going through the exact same thing, it gets very lonely. Like Dolly is one of my closest friends, which I feel like I should say, because you've brought up her review of the book, and she's you know, brought it up on the high low. And she is somebody who is incredibly successful in her field. Like she's you know, so well known. She's had this huge podcast, this huge book or whatever. And I think if I wasn't such good friends with her, I would probably be able to look at her life and be like, oh, Jesus, she has everything.
Yeah.
But then when you're actually really good friends with someone, you begin to see how difficult that level of success actually is, how it doesn't solve any of your problems, how it actually creates more problems than mm-hmm. it solves. And you're able to actually, it completely removes that jealousy element. And yeah. you're able to be like, God, it's just, everyone's just has everyone's just handed out a bucket of shit and it's got like slightly different amounts of shit in it. You know what I mean? She's dealing with shit, I'm dealing with shit, you know?
I know. And it's all relative, really. You know, it is, I think that, again, it's a welcoming world, the world of podcasting. So when you're not writing best-selling novels, you have an outstanding podcast, Sentimental Garbage. But it's a symbiotic world, isn't it? Like, from working in radio, you would never invite somebody on your radio show from a rival radio station. But yet the world of podcasting is so, symbiotic really is just the word that comes to mind about it.
That's such an interesting point. Mm. And I'd never thought about it that way. Yeah, definitely. And I definitely think that there is and you're right. And the podcast actually was, my intention in creating that was twofold. It's called Sentimental Garbage. It's about sort of appreciating commercial female literature. Mm-hmm. Your Marianne Keyes's, your Kathy Kelly's, Jilly Cooper, all that stuff that like thousands of women read, but doesn't get a lot of space in review sections in newspapers.
Yeah.
And that is something I feel really strongly about, that there is, an incredible amount of women doing incredible work, but very few of it is actually discussed with intellectual credibility. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I feel like every sort of 10 years, one woman is allowed to be like, quote unquote, important. And so I think that encourages a lot of rivalries.
Yeah,
I think it encourages a lot of, people looking at the generation coming down up below them and being, and because the way female books are marketed is very much about like a lot of picture taking, a lot of outfit wearing. Women are treated differently in publishing in a way that it does hinge on their youth. It does hinge on what they take, how they take a photograph. And that's disgusting, but unfortunately part of the job.
It's so disappointing. Isn't it?
It like, is. I mean,
given what goes into creating the piece of work that you have, like yours that you just released, like it's incredible, and it's so disappointing that you still have to deal with that stuff that you just wouldn't imagine from the outside. You wouldn't think it's necessary. It's certainly not important to the reader.
Yeah, completely. And like, I think some women that I know are really able to like draw a line in the sand and they're like, no, I'm not doing that. But you will find, like, you'll find that most of them have a beauty shots, basically. Mm. Like, we can call them press shots, but what they are beauty shots. Sorry, I feel like I'm talking out of turn, really. I've never really spoken about this, but they run a thing about the book, and after a certain point, and I've worked in media, so I get it, they don't want to keep running pictures of the same book cover, or the same picture of you from your author jacket from 5 mm-hmm. years ago or whatever. And they want to run, and if they're gonna like give it space in the magazine or in the newspaper, they want to have a nice image, and of course that nice image should be of you, and you're a young woman, so why not? And then suddenly mm-hmm. you're getting your makeup done, and suddenly you're in an outfit you've never worn before, and you're a bit like, what? Like, I'm supposed to have the cerebral job and I'm here. Yeah. Like, I've talked a lot about that with my female friends, and that we all sort of like, who are in the industry, and we all sort of jar against it in different ways.
And so, so your podcast celebrates, I suppose, chick lit, really. And you know, when you talk about the genre of it, and I suppose the lack of appreciation for that genre, it's almost put in the category of a guilty pleasure. And that's disappointing. And in fact, I just don't think there should be a thing as a guilty pleasure. If it makes you happy and it's legal, I mean, why should you be guilty about it? But that is, I know friends who have bought Kindles before they go on holiday, so they're not going to be judged on what they would consider, the reading pool side. But like, it's disappointing, isn't it?
It can be, yeah. And I do understand that sometimes, like, the things that other people tend to call guilty pleasures, I feel like they haven't read that book. And they, like for example, I got really into Jilly Cooper this year.
Yeah.
And I read Riders, and I thought it was just phenomenal. And, like, obviously, there's loads of writing in it. And it is saucy. And I do get what people are like, okay, I'm reading an extremely graphic sex scene that's like been written specifically so I'll feel turned on. And I get how they would feel a bit like guilty about that. But also in that book is like, I learned so much about the sport of show jumping while reading that. And I was like, that I never knew about before, and the history of show jumping. And I was like, I feel like I could now go to a show jumping like event and know what I was looking at. And that's an incredible feat, you know?
Isn't it? And it's not really why someone goes to Jilly Cooper, but I mean, it's there, absolutely. But
those books are so well researched, and all of her books are so well researched. Like she had the sequel to Riders is Rivals, and it's like a corporate television takeover. And
I love
it. Completely, you totally believe the world. And she with all of her books, she like basically spends 3 years living in the world that she is writing about, whether it's classical music or show jumping or corporate TV worlds or whatever. And she lives it. And it's like, I think she really is amazing at capturing worlds in a way that few writers are. And I was like if you want to call Jilly Cooper a guilty pleasure, like you are missing out.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And I mean, it would just be disappointing if that was the case. I'm sure she doesn't care whether it is or not because she's Jilly Cooper. But the level of research, and even I always loved at the start of those books that there was like the table of all the characters and you could revert back to that. And like, it just felt like you were getting into something really special. And it's, you know, they're a lengthy tome as well, so you know it takes a bit of time to get through them, but it's like starting a good series almost.
Totally. And do you know what's funny as well is that like I think the way people talk about chick lit has quite a lot in common with how people used to talk about like fantasy.
Yes,
about like not, I mean obviously everyone has had a certain amount of respect for like Tolkien, but like, you know, the kind of your basic sort of 80s paperback with the dragon on the cover, and then you know at the front there's like some maps and a cast of characters or whatever, and who's related to who that you can refer back to.
Yeah.
And then sort of like Game of Thrones came along and it made it all so legitimate.
Yeah.
And then people started respecting fantasy as a genre, and they started respecting that, okay, maybe you might think on the outset that this book is about a dragon, but actually it's about, you know, weapons of mass destruction, and like that's what a dragon is, and that's what the stand-in is in this book kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I would love if like, and I think it happened briefly with like the Nora Ephron romantic comedies. I would love it if it would come back again for sort of romance. Do you know what I mean? I really wish that we could, because like by and large, people have stopped making rom-coms. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, as you said, that's because Hugh Grant isn't available anymore. He was busy, so who else could be that guy, you know? But I wonder, what does it have to take then? What does it have to take to bring them back? Like, you know, the rom-coms. It's a funny thing, isn't it?
I think actually what's happened is Sally Rooney, really. I think that she's doing it because she's written this like very straightforward romance between like two young, beautiful people in Trinity. And like, it's obviously beautifully written, but it is a romance, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's given people permission, that book, to take romance seriously again. And also the TV show has done that as well. And I think that is part of a new movement, I think.
It's amazing.
I think people will look back on that book and the TV adaptation of it as being like, oh, this was us ushering in a new phase of how we talk about and think about romance on screen and in books. Because if you think about it, I think there was like there was your kind of like your 60s, like Doris Day romantic comedies or whatever, and that was a certain genre. And then we had the 90s where it was like Nora Ephron and Richard Curtis owned that genre. And then ever since then, it's been this like big gap. And I think we're ready for a renaissance again.
And what about an adaptation of your work? Is that something you dream of or hope for? Or is it just like a happy accident if it occurs?
Well, obviously everyone, like I don't believe authors who say that they don't think about their adaptations. And I am in the works with getting something adapted at the moment, but I can't talk too much about it.
I'd like to be in that situation where I'm like, I just can't talk about it.
I know, I feel so self-important even just saying that.
But that's amazing if so. That's wonderful. And I mean, you know, I often read books like yours and think, why is this not on the screen? You know, why is this not? Because it is just the perfect story to tell visually as well, you know?
I hope so. I really, really hope that Scenes of a Graphic Nature does someday get to screen.
Yeah.
Just because I think that there's a lot in that book that hasn't been on screen yet.
Yeah.
Like, I'm obsessed with the concept of female road trip movies. Do you know what I mean? Like, there was Thelma and Louise happened, obviously. And it was like the hugest movie ever. And then nobody bothered to follow up with anything.
No. What about you do something like this then? Because obviously I'm a fan of your columns and I love them in the Irish Examiner. But The Woman Holiday is what you talked about recently. And I live for them. Like, you know, my poor husband, we could go on 5 trips, but I would be giddy at the thoughts of going away with just a couple of my pals and locking ourselves into an apartment and drinking wine and talking rubbish. There's something special about that, isn't there?
Oh my God, I love it so much. Chatting, absolute breeze. Like, yes. So I write this column every week for the Irish Examiner. And that one was far and away, I've gotten the most sort of information. I've most of emails, the most texts and tweets about that column. And what I was afraid when I was writing it a little bit, because I was like, oh God, am I the only one who feels this way? But I love my boyfriend so much, and I love when we go away together and we go to festivals together and we've gone traveling and we've done lots of very exciting things. But there's like, when we go on a sun holiday together, the first 2 days is mostly him sleeping and not putting SPF on and us sort of having mild arguments.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, you're just kind of sitting, waiting around being like, hey, when's he going to wake up? But when you go on holidays with a woman from the get-go, all you're doing is talking shite and having the best time.
And goodiness at the very start, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hopefully, maybe, perhaps an adaptation on the way. We won't talk about it. But what about you? You've been writing furiously during lockdown, 5,000 words a day when help has gone away. You know, we hoped. But what's happening? Book 3. When could we expect something as wonderful as that?
Wow. So I've got a young adult series that is coming out in February.
Lovely.
And that's sort of aimed at age 14 up, and it's kind of what I'm really excited about it actually is that it's very much set in Cork and very much inspired by growing up there and kind of being kind of a sort of adolescence that I never get to see in books. Mm-hmm. That sort of thing where everybody sort of knows each other, it's a city, everybody's in a band, everybody goes to gigs, sort of and that's been a big fun to write. It's also very much about witchcraft. Because I was very much a trainee Wiccan.
You were dark when you were 17.
I thought I was. I was so into like spells and all that kind of stuff.
Wonderful.
And I still have a lot of respect for that community and that art in general. And so it's very much based in my kind of interests. So that's going to be hopefully a 3-book series.
Yeah.
And I can't talk about it too much, but that's the thing that is kind of currently might be in the works for getting adapted.
Oh wow, look, there's such exciting things to come.
And
you know, your career has been a joy to watch. I think you're so talented, be it even on Twitter or, you know, in those columns or your podcast. There's so much to enjoy, so just keep it coming. And thank you so much for coming on to the Brown Thomas podcast to chat to us today.
I've loved it. This has been my favorite podcast I've done in absolutely ages. Thank you so much.
Delighted, Caroline. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Brown Thomas podcast. If you like what you've heard, be sure to subscribe and share, and follow us on Official Brown Thomas on Instagram for more updates.